Culture for everyone.
Saturday mornings from 11.
That's supposed to be Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falkenstein for Falcon Screen, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Yo, yo, yo.
And freelance writer and critic of Rotten Eru.
Hello, people of the world who are everywhere.
We've got a few exciting things that are happening this week. We're talking about the Sydney Film Festival. It is back. First release. This festival is running through August. However, we know some of the films that are out, so we're going to be chatting about some of the highlights. We're also going to be talking about The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard. I kept getting the title confused, but it is The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard in cinemas now. God help us. And also later talking about two, controversies that have beset the DC and Marvel Universe, respectively, about how studios associated with the brands have objected to certain intimacy and intimate acts, whether they be in narratives or in real life.
It gives us an opportunity to get up on our soapbox and complain about comic book movies in Hollywood again.
Yes, corporates have ruined cinema.
Yeah, any excuse will do.
And also just to note, happening locally next Tuesday is Kino Sydney 158, so get your flicks in. We'll be there and watching some cool short films. But first, we want to talk about the Sydney Film Festival. We missed a full festival run last year. It is happening this year. They are running a regular amount, I think a little fewer films than previously, and but a number of more sessions too. Sessions running at 75% capacity, but allowing a number of people as expected in any regular year to attend.
So it's going to be one to book early, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, we are probably the ones who book the earliest anyway. We have our flexi 30s ready to slot in our 30 films or whatever.
Not me. I'm always grabbing last minute. Oh, is there an extra seat in that thing I should have booked when the program was announced? Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'll swapping out last minute is actually a good idea. It's usually kind of because you sometimes realize that films you'd booked out and then, oh, the first screening is bad. That's why you book out for the second one.
Right.
You wait for the critical reaction. Anyway, this is hot takes about how to book for Sydney Film Fest.
I suspect they'll be doing something like online screenings to kind of balance for the 75% capacity rule, given that they ran that pretty successfully last year, an online-only festival. And given that a lot of people are still afraid to come out, I doubt they'll be dropping that, but we'll see when the program's properly announced.
Yeah, to note, there was a small Sydney Film Festival run in January at the State Theatre. It was successful. They sold it at the state capacity, and they also, I think you had to arrive at different times for the purpose of social distancing in the line because there's quite a throng of people. So I think the we're going to have to look to a different type of festival environment this year, but looking to screen as many films as they can, have as many people as possible. Simply the fact that it may take, you may be able to see a few sessions, but still some of the best films are getting released out of Cannes and Berlinale, which is pretty cool. Zola, the Twitter thread that was morphed into a feature film.
Yeah, there's a few films that I've been really keen to catch actually in the lineup. The ones I'm most excited about, Undine.
Undine, yes, the new Christian adult.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There was also another good film by Neil Jordan about Undine, the myth. Like 10, 15 years ago.
From what I'm hearing about
the this one's about
Undine,
really good.
Yeah, it's all very positive.
I thought his last one, Transit, was terrific.
Yeah, it's
a mixed views on Transit, but I'd watch anything from this director.
Yeah. He's a very strong director, and he's on a big run of buzzed about films right now. I'm also really excited to see Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, the new Ryusuke Hamaguchi. Yeah. I was a big proponent of his first two films, Happy Hour and Asako 1+2. And this one's getting great reviews. There's also a new film from him in the Cannes lineup. So potentially, if they land that, we'll be seeing two films from one director at SFF. We'll see.
Hopefully the new Verhoeven yet to be announced, but many will potentially.
Yeah, they haven't announced anything that's in the Cannes official selection yet.
No.
So we'll wait and see.
I'm pretty sure the Farhadi might get a nod in because given how
he always plays, he's such a like
SFF fixture.
Fixture.
You'll be there. It'll be great.
Yeah. Plays easy to the middle brow audiences.
Yeah.
And that's not a slight at the films. The films are great. I'm just saying they're very accessible, very based in dramatic tradition in a way that's comfortable and familiar, you know.
But we haven't had many Iranian films as such recently, but now we have two. We have also have There Is No Evil.
Yeah, Mohammad Rasoulouf's film.
Which, and he's under house arrest currently because of this film.
And this one, the Golden Lion, right? Sorry, the Golden Bear at Berlin.
Berlin, yeah. So I'm excited for it. It's an anthology which is bringing about four stories together in contemporary Iran. So.
And it's about the death penalty, as I understand it.
Yeah. So intense.
More, it's going to be harsh criticism of the government, I'm sure.
Yeah, but I think this is probably the thing I love about Iranian cinema is the fact that it's able to produce such humanistic dramas, which are also incredibly piercing critique of the establishment, while it is such a closely censored environment.
But they manage, maybe this is because of the censoriousness of the environment, and maybe it's because of Iranian culture, but they manage not to be didactic.
Yeah.
I find Iranian films in
yeah, they're usually very good. A Separation, one of my favorites in the past 10 years, manages to be broadly accessible and excellent critique and play as a pure drama absent its strong political overtones. To note, the Iranian Film Festival Australia is actually closes tonight.
Oh, really?
So I think you can catch a couple of screenings still online.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Riders of Justice, the new Mads Mikkelsen, keen for that.
Yeah,
the publicity shots look good. I'm up for that. Dear Comrades, a film we've discussed privately out of Russia.
We have someone who since last year has been saying he wants to come on the show to talk about it, so maybe you'll get your chance.
Yeah. Dear Comrades, Jonathan, dear listeners.
let's not call listeners dear friends. No, our listeners aren't comrades. They're friends.
Comrades in arms. Okay, fine.
Right. Yes. The subject matter for the film is very...
When our communist revolution comes, we know who's going to be first against the wall.
Yeah. bring it.
Am I a comrade now, Glenn?
Yes. Come find us. Come find us. I'm keen for it. August 18 through 29, Morris City Film Festival, running between all the theatres, doing... at Palace Central too now.
Yeah, well, I guess they have to now that Dendy's out. But, yeah, it's surprising to me that they're not running at the United Cinemas Opera Keys, which has just replaced Dendy.
But in a way, it's a good thing because of Vivid, I've never really liked
to go to Opera Keys. I love that cinema, but, man, it's such a hassle to get to because there's a huge crush of people because of Vivid. And when they announced that SFF was moving to August, I thought, yes, dodging Vivid. And then they announced that Vivid was moving to August as well. Yes. It's just a cruel joke.
It just keeps following.
Yeah.
But I remember my favorite, or like, you know, not probably not the favorite, but just a haunting memory of Dendy Opera Keys when Chris and I were there. 10 a.m. show of Elephants Sitting Still.
Oh, man.
That was film.
That's the place to go for the punishingly long, miserablest, bleak.
Yeah, but it's also like, you know, where else you can do a 10 a.m. screening, well, which, you know, is going to be 5 hours.
Well, I also did Satan Tango there at 10 a.m.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was...
7.5 hours.
Yeah, 7.5 or 8 hours, I think. 450 minutes, or, 7.5 hours.
Yeah, just, you know. There's a Lav Diaz that played there as well.
Yeah. A woman who left. I saw that there as well, actually.
Yeah.
And I saw the Turin Horse there, which is only 2 hours, 40 minutes from Bellatar, who did Satan Tango.
Short.
A short one from him. But that's the place to go when you want to see.
But that's the thing.
Not anymore.
That's the thing. Now I don't know, because I used to love the feeling that you can just rest your thing, because I used to book the aisle.
Lean against the wall. Because the wall's right there.
Have a nap, and that's something that I'm going to miss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should just be able to fall asleep in these movies. You watch such a volume, it's considered perfectly okay to just sit for 10 minutes here and there and just rest. It's totally okay.
I like that Lav Diaz, who did The Woman Who Left, stated that it's okay if you fall asleep in my films. I don't mind. It's understandable.
His new one, which is out, which I've seen on Festival Scope, if they get picked up as well, it's going to be interesting.
Is it really good?
It's really good, yeah.
Yeah,
it's
cool.
It's just, you know.
He's dependably good. He's consistently good. They're just all 4 hours long.
So that's the Film Festival coming up on August 18th. You're listening to Film Fight Club on 2SER with Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans and Murat Nehru. The next film we're talking about is The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard, the sequel to The Hitman's Bodyguard. To note, we had a bet last time as to how many times Sam Jackson said a particular word that starts with M.
A particular word he's associated with. Can we say this on TourCR? I feel like this is
motherfucker. The word is motherfucker.
We can say motherfucker because this, yeah, the context. This is not important. Gratuitous.
It's not.
Is justified by the context. Okay.
Yeah.
It was 15 last time. Guess how many it was? I counted again.
Oh, nice. You've got to do something to keep yourself entertained in a film like this.
Oh yeah.
It's not just Samuel Jackson that says the word. It's a lot of people have co-opted the word in this film.
I think he's the only one who actually says it. Others, people say variations thereof.
Yeah. What's the number?
Guess.
He probably only said it like 7 times in Spiral from the Book of Saw.
Okay, for this film, I'm going to say it's more than 20. It's 22.
22? It was 14. Oh. One less than last time, interestingly.
Huh.
Okay.
I think it was just there were all the other swearing that happened ancillary to him, so I think they felt we can even this out. Anyway, he's back along with
he's back.
So is Selma Hayek. So is Ryan Reynolds. Antonio Banderas is here now. The guy from the Avengers, Frank Grillo, is that his?
Right.
Is here. We're going to get into that. But they're all back, and Ryan Reynolds' character, the bodyguard, is having a crisis of faith. And there's a plot to destroy Europe.
So, yeah, someone has this magical USB thumb drive that when you put it into like a certain computer, like, oh, it's the power grid or whatever, it creates like magic electric lightning that makes everything blow up around Europe.
No, it's called an electrical surge that knocks out the electrical grid. It's supposedly scientifically accurate.
But it results in like crashing trains and, you know.
Yeah, this is one of those
Y2K-esque destruction.
It's
a deep cut for the oldies.
The producers of this film, that was the thing. Remember when all the CEOs the airlines had to be on a plane at midnight in 2000 because they were like, no, the plane's not going to crash. Yeah, every airline.
Oh, wow.
It was a little tidbit of history. But no, this is one of those films where the producers just clearly didn't think that people would care what happens in Zagreb, not just the capital and a city with people, but a major world capital. I remember in Mission Impossible 5, the Austrian president dies and just it's never brought up again. A major thing happens in the center of Zagreb, and it's like never mentioned. Like, who cares?
Yeah,
Croatia,
yeah,
where's that?
Whatever.
But yeah. Clearly, the hero of this film is Antonio Banderas.
Who I wanted to talk about. Yeah. So he's the villain.
He's playing Aristotle, a beautiful Greek man.
He's not just Greek, he's called Aristotle. He's like the most Greek, but it's just Antonio Banderas speaking with his normal voice and accent, saying like, "I love Greek culture."
That's the beautiful thing about it. It's like he's not even trying, but it's the kind of right level of camp that is required for
funny.
This film.
He can do this kind of thing with a blindfold on.
Yeah,
Zorro. He was very funny. That there's a bit where he talks about how like Greece will
rise.
We'll be the center of the world. Yeah, we'll be the center of the world once again. It's such a great like dumb screenwriter created supervillain.
Oh yeah, the Greek guy who wants them to go back to like ancient Greece. Yeah, that'll be cool.
Greece are the bad guy here.
I know.
It's funny. Actually, this will play quite well in Athens and surrounds.
No, the EU is the bad guy.
Well, the Hague were the screw-ups last time, and now the EU are on notice.
What's great about
ridiculous? Look, in an age where there actually is quite serious ultranationalism in Greece, to see someone like this taken so not seriously is actually quite fun and great.
It's hilarious.
Should we talk about the plot a bit better?
What else is there to say? The other driving plot is that Ryan Reynolds and Sam Jackson are having this, hate fest amongst each other. And there's conflict also between Sam Jackson and Selma Hayek character because she wants to start a family and she's not sure where he's up to with that. And that's a major driving motivational force behind all of her actions in the film.
Look, before we completely abandon Aristotle and the quest for Greek pride to be restored.
We're not making fun of this. This is actually part of the
film. No, that is the plot, yeah. I love it when... there's this current trend, I don't actually love it, where you identify a real problem, you have a villain who wants to counter for that, and then we just defeat the villain, so everything's fine, just go back to normal. Like in Kingsman, it's like, well, climate change is bad.
Actually, I'm going
to do something extreme and ridiculous to fight climate change. Okay, so we kill that guy because he's a bad guy, but then like, okay, so we're just not going to address the climate change. So it's like,
riots in Greece, according to the universe of this film, like serious stuff going on separate to the actions of Aristotle.
Right, exactly.
I think in Kingsman is a good example because, In that film, we also had a very outlandish villain who wanted to...
Right.
Who was a climate warrior, if anything else. The lefties were the baddies in that film.
As they are in the Kingsman films. But in this one, Aristotle is anti... austerity measures. That's an interesting motivation that makes sense. There's great reasons to be anti-imposed austerity measures, right?
Once again, it's like kind of a left-wing policy, and it's
well, it's a little more debatable how that sits on the spectrum in Greece. Yeah. But having an ultra-villain take that position is interesting in the context of Greek politics and the extent to which the EU have intervened and sought to enact reforms impacting Greece.
Yeah.
But we don't get into this.
This is outside the scope of this discussion. The movie is about Ryan Reynolds being Kenny from South Park.
Indestructible. This is the thing. He can survive anything. They all can survive anything.
Okay.
But walk away.
The central gag of this film is Ryan Reynolds
getting smashed.
Grievously injured. Yeah, constantly, and he keeps coming back
the first
up.
One, to be clear, like, it's the same gag as the first one.
But it felt way more extreme. Maybe it's just my faded memory of the first one, but it felt way more extreme to me in this one.
Yeah, it definitely was. There was a moment which I felt was funnier because I kind of felt like, what if he was actually dead all this time?
Yeah, me and Virat, when we were watching it, we were like, yeah, maybe he's actually dead and they're doing a Weekend at Bernie's thing where they're driving around Ryan Reynolds'
corpse. Which would be actually funny.
I would have enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But, he gets hit by cars that they, like, throw his body. Oh, he's like, oh, he'll be fine. Throw his unconscious.
Drowns.
Yeah, drowns. They throw his unconscious body in the back of a car and, like, he falls over a seat and smashes his head against it, like a big block of concrete and stuff like that. And it's all fine and played for laughs. It loops back around to being funny. For me, like, it's not funny in the way it's intended to be, but it's just so gratuitous and
becomes ironically funny by the end of it.
Like, what is this seriously? am I meant to? I know I'm not meant to take it seriously, but I'm meant to engage with this like it's okay and fine watching this guy getting pulverized constantly, and none of the characters care. Like, Sam Jackson is basically making jokes about it, like, haha, he's dead, I'm not torn up about it.
He's also subjected to just, you know.
Constant humiliation.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I would feel bad for him. Usually when movies have these kind of cruel jokes at someone's expense,
the character is neurotic and is somehow, you know...
Yeah, yeah, he's got a tough guy.
Emotional stuff. And on this emotional stuff, the stuff he goes through is really... We see in flashbacks, it's really intense, but it's played for laughs and gratuitously.
And the thing is that
there was one death which is very close to the Meet Joe Black kind of death.
Oh, yeah.
Which was not... Required.
We're referring to the outrageous scene where Brad Pitt's character gets hit by multiple cars in a way that's clearly staged, and there's several moments like that in this film, but even more gratuitous.
Yeah, like the flashback about his mum's death, which is so brutal
I was going to refer to because I was just
think of the gorilla thing in Team America, but played out explicitly.
Right.
Yeah.
And the thing is, his character is so annoying. Usually when there's this kind of cruelty at someone's expense, I vibe against it. Like,
so harsh.
Give this guy a break. But Ryan Reynolds' character is that despicable.
He just wanted him to be dead.
I was hoping that he would just be dead and they'd be taking his body along for the ride. Because through the whole movie, he's just getting trashed. Like, and then at the end, he has to redeem himself.
That would kind of make a nice play on, like, Hitman's wife's bodyguard, who's been dead all this time. How he's going to protect them?
That would be a much more interesting film. We didn't get that.
We have another special appearance.
Morgan Freeman. He's just sleepwalking through this film.
He does not care. Morgan Freeman does not give a damn.
He knows this is terrible.
He's cashing a paycheck. It's half self-referential and meta because there's a reference to everyone liking his voice. It's, we need someone cool to be in this. You guys know Morgan Freeman. Let's bring him in. He'll enjoy this. He just kind of stands around and does stuff. The scenes where he's required to do interactive martial arts, I appreciate it's very just... not well staged compared to the others in the film. He does sleepwalk through this. He's on autopilot.
The
he does
action
not care.
In this film is not really notable.
Some of the hand-to-hand fight sequences are good. The problem is the camera, particularly seen in the club, the problem is the camera work is just a little too choppy.
In general, I found the cinematography of this to be awful.
And it's like very plasticky.
Yeah, I empathize more and more with the super pro film people. Like when the switch to digital happened and there were some people saying like, oh, you know, something really beautiful has been lost. And
it's true because in the teaser of the new Wong Kar Wai Blossoms looks horrible as well because it's digital.
I think digital can look very good. Yeah. I defended digital against such people when these debates were raging, you know, saying, yeah, but, you know, the essence of the cinematic medium isn't like film strips. It's like the language, and you can do that just as well in digital. You can still have glorious cinematography, et cetera. But I have noticed a trend where we accept trash looking movies. Like,
and this when is you, a trash.
This is a trash looking movie. Yeah. Like, when one film, if you've done a poor job with the cinematography, at least once it's recorded to film, it still has this nice, lustrous sheen. But this, Spiral from the Book of Saw was another one where you look at some of the shots and it's like, man, that just looks like I pointed a camera at something without setting up the lights. That is ugly.
And it's worse than that. The sequences, they could have just filmed in Italy or something that looks like Italy. There are clearly scenes that are CGI. You should not have to CGI a field in the middle of, I don't know, near Tuscany or wherever.
Yeah, like, could they not have gone to a real field?
It gets worse where there's a scene where they're driving through Italy and they're in a car and it looks like a 50s film where Elvis is driving along.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's very clear there's a car and a backdrop. I just couldn't believe, given the three actors who are in the shot, we're talking Hayek, Ryan Reynolds, and Sam Jackson, three A-listers are suddenly looking like they're in the middle of a 50s movie.
It is, yeah.
Lazy.
It is a cheap-looking movie. And also, I leant over to Virat during the scene when we had the flashback to Ryan Reynolds' hilarious death of his mom.
Hilarious in quotation marks.
Which is not hilarious. Yeah.
No, it's not hilarious. Yeah. Which is one of the ugliest things I've seen in a major motion picture. It looks like they've sent out unit with like a crappy DSLR or something.
Yeah,
it's like
the flashback bleached, color grading. Yeah, it's horrible.
It looked horrible.
Well, the whole film was horrible, but this was particularly horrible.
Also,
horribler and a horribless.
The way they treat Selma Hayek in this movie, I counted three jokes about her boobs, two jokes about her butt, like.
And just
it's so retrograde, right? Like, she's just here to be like, hey, she's sexy.
Well, also not just that. She's also playing this kind of enhanced version of what Sofia Vergara's character was reduced to in Modern Family, because she's Latino.
She's the angry screaming Latino woman. Yeah.
And that was something which was so weird.
It's weird to just see it.
She was a more detailed and nuanced character, and more interesting character, more fun, and a character to watch in the first film by design. I think they wanted to draw a lot of the conflict out of her and did that in a very narrow and singularly dimensional way.
She just is there to kind of like, I just want to pop out babies. It was so weird. And she just literally says that.
Hold on. That's a fine motivation for a person.
I know, but she says that like that and it just feels weird.
What's wrong with that? I don't take issue with that. Something I do take issue with is the kind of characterization of the Frank Grillo character, who's just from Boston and in Europe, suddenly at the head of the EU investigation task force. And with the amount, and his character made no sense. It was a subplot entirely extraneous to the main core action of the group of characters we know.
And then they have Scottish accent jokes as well.
Racism towards the Scottish community. They make all these jokes about how the Scottish interpreter who's interpreting for the American.
She was easy to understand.
Apparently, she's not, according to this film.
And you know what? Like, Scottish accents can be goddamn hard to understand. Like, if you watch Ratcatcher, especially Ratcatcher or Morven Colour without the subtitles and understand every line of dialogue, I dare you. Those are the first two features by Lynn Ramsey, by the way. Good movies. But yeah, she was not hard to understand. She sounds like an urbanite Scot. You know, she's not like from way out in the country in the 70s.
Yeah, but the thing with this character was, it was underwritten and the actress and the actor, some performers can rise up other material. The particular actress, I don't think, did. It's very hard to, given how poorly written it was. Just,
she didn't have much to do.
Let's make fun of some Scottish people because this is going to be the gag for this movie.
Nothing in this movie was well thought out, so it was just...
It's a terrible movie.
It finished. What was the best part about the film?
Frank Grillo is the actor's name, isn't it? I'm going to look it up. I'm pretty sure. I just want to point out something I actually did appreciate about this, and I did talk about this in the context of the last film. Usually we have to deal with actors, not a problem, but who are quite in their 20s or early 30s, and there aren't a lot of roles for A-listers in major Hollywood set pieces, including especially for women, over a certain age. Ryan Reynolds, who's the youngest main actor in this film, is 44. The other main actors are 54, 60, 72, and 84.
Yeah, wow.
So, cool. Good.
I kept thinking of Red. I think it's Morgan Freeman's appearance in this, like oldies action movie.
But there's not much action to begin, like, anyway. It's not an action movie either.
Frank Grillo.
Right. It is an action movie. It's just that the action's so bad.
Yeah, okay.
The action is very bad. And I remember that a couple of really good scenes in the film, particularly a scene in a as part of a restaurant in the kitchen where there was a lot of very brutal hand-to-hand combat, and that worked well. But this film had the same issue as the first film, where they can never quite decide on the acceptable level of violence in this universe. Some scenes, things just glance people. Some scenes are very, very brutal. Mm. You have to have a consistent or otherwise escalating tone, but this jumps around a lot, and it ruined a lot of the first film. At least this one had some thematic coherency in that the first film, half of it was written as a serious drama, and then Ryan Reynolds came on, and suddenly it's no longer a war crime thriller drama. It's a Deadpool-esque comedy. At least in this one, there was a more consistent approach, but the haphazard
dumb,
tone is
really
still
dumb comedy.
Just dumb comedy. They try to bring the emotional aspects into it, where it's like we're supposed to care about these characters' backstories.
But when the rest of the time they're telling you not to care at all, like in the way that they treat Ryan Reynolds' character.
Yeah. He did, everything he does now is a variation of Deadpool in some respect.
Movies are unable to escape their formulas.
I'm actually watching, in preparation for Fast 9, which we'll cover it next week, I am watching Hobbs v. Shaw for the first time.
Right.
And he's playing, oh God, this lousy CIA agent.
Yeah, I feel like movies can't escape their formulas these days. So often you see movies, instead of going for a different formula, they make fun of the formula that they're still adhering to.
Yeah.
This is one of those sorts of movies. We, instead of allowing it just to be a dumb movie that's misanthropic and doesn't care about anyone, even though we've demeaned Ryan Reynolds and his pain through the entire movie, then suddenly you've got to have the emotional bit at the end, because that's what happens at the end of these movies.
It's supposed to care.
Like, you are unable to escape from that formula, even though this movie is 100% not that.
Talking about carefully controlled formulas and people controlling products,
yep.
I think
so,
it's a nice segue into our next.
Yep. So The Hitman's Bodyguard is in cinemas now. You're listening to Film Fight Club on 2CR. In the last few minutes, we want to talk about a story that broke in the past day and how it relates to a not unrelated story that broke last week in relation to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. The story that broke today, I saw it in Variety, is that regards a Harley Quinn animated adult series. People involved in production have reportedly said that we cannot depict Batman going down on Harley Quinn.
But Catwoman.
Catwoman. Because it's a Harley Quinn series.
Because heroes don't do that.
Because we'd be able to sell toys.
I wish it was my line, but I saw a few people jump out with the response that, like, that's exactly what heroes do. But yeah, it's true. Like, but the weird thing about it is Batman has been depicted having sex in comics.
Yeah.
But in recent years.
The Killing Joke.
And also
one of the best scenes in Batman Returns, it wasn't a sex scene explicitly, but right. The sequence he shared with Catwoman.
But Batman's been depicted in comics in the last 5 years having sex with Catwoman. Seriously.
Yeah.
But he's not allowed to go down on her.
It shouldn't be an issue. And there's certainly,
man on top.
And there's certainly a broad approach to
missionary only.
And a lot unrelated to what we saw happen last week with Marvel reportedly objecting to photographs of Taika Waititi sharing friendly, intimate moments with it was two persons who were involved in the production.
Rita Ora and Tessa Thompson.
Tessa Thompson. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with these photos, but apparently this doesn't go with the brand of incredibly sanitized. Where everything has to. There's never been a really palpable romance or eroticism. I don't mean eroticism in an explicit way. I just mean a palpable sense of romance in any of these films. There were in the X-Men films back in 2000 with Jean Grey and Hugh Jackman.
Yeah.
There was in the first Spider-Man. And even the other ones, too.
Spider-Man films are romance films, but the Marvel films are deathly afraid of romance. After the photos of Waititi and the controversy came out, some people on Twitter started doing counts of all the kisses in Marvel movies and how many of them were ever really hot. One of the things that was refreshing about Zack Snyder's Justice League is it had some, it was just a brief moment, but still, it had some actual sensual human eroticism depicted with Superman and Lois Lane.
And it's not age appropriate, it's just intimate relations between adults.
Yeah, that's the problem with the position we're now in, where we constantly have superhero stuff shoved down our throats, including by us here on Film Fight Club right now, where we just can't stop being bombarded with superhero content and superhero discussions and superhero. Is that it's almost like there's a demand that we as adults take it seriously, but the content is stubbornly refusing to be adult. The content has to be childish. That's what these corporate mandates are telling you. The content cannot explore the human experience in depth, and that includes sexuality. It's kids' cartoons.
Because it's also not just that. It's also because it's so corporatized where you cannot be sure that this might offend someone. So you are appealing to the broadest common denominator, which is why it has to be sanitized to a certain extent. They just want to sell toys.
So that
and
is
not that kind of toys either.
So that is our, so that is our latest views on the state of the superhero universe.
Nothing's changed. Still hate them.
We'll be back next week covering Furious 9 as well as In the Heights, the new Lin-Manuel Miranda musical adaptation. Hitman's Bodyguard is in cinemas now. Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard, excuse me. And you can go check out the Sydney Film Festival pre-program. Stay tuned for The Sonic Assassin. Let us know what you want us to fight about. And please subscribe on iTunes and Spotify. This has been Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans, and Virat Nehru on 2SCR. Have a wonderful night and enjoy movies. Good night.
Bye.